Hello all, and welcome to Satellite Profile Theater's podcast that deepens our audience's connection to the work itself, the process of creating the work, and the artists doing the work. I'm Tamara Carroll, Profile's Director of Community Engagement, bringing you our second episode orbiting the upcoming production of Reggie Hoops, written by Christopher Diaz and directed by Melissa Crespo. And for this episode, I got to talk to Reggie Hoops director Melissa Crespo. Crespo is a New York-based artist with Dominican, Puerto Rican, and Chilean roots. She's a director of theater, opera, and film, and like me, she is particularly interested in developing and directing new work. She's also a producer, playwright, educator, and the associate artistic director at Syracuse Stage in Syracuse, New York. I think my favorite part of this interview actually is in the last third of it, when I asked Melissa about her relationship to hip-hop music and culture, which is ever-present in Chris Diaz's work. And I hope y'all enjoy listening as much as I enjoyed getting to have this conversation. Welcome, folks, to not the basement of the Imago Theater this time. We are in a very special location, which is the office of the Imago Theater. And joining me in this small, disused, and vaguely uncomfortably warm office is Melissa Crespo. Welcome.
Thank you.
Our guest artists are so understanding about the various situations.
It's the magic of theater. We're making it.
Yeah. For all you know, listening at home or at the gym, I don't know where people listen to their podcasts, we could be in like a suite.
Yeah, you know, like a Zoom and you make up a background, like a fake background, like just make up a fake background in your mind.
Yes, yes. Melissa, is this your first time in Portland?
This is my second time in Portland. The first time was in 2019. I directed Native Gardens by Karen Zacharias at Portland Center Stage.
Yeah. That'd be great. I am sorry to say I did not see that production.
No worries.
But I know that it happened.
Yeah. It was fun. It was great. But I was only here for about a week and a half because it was a co-production.
Uh-huh.
And the show originated at Syracuse Stage and then came here. And so it was already done.
Gotcha.
So we just teched it. And I didn't get to spend all of the wonderful time I am right now.
Yeah. Are you getting to enjoy some of the city?
Yeah. The food here is awesome. And I think the scene here is really fun. It's definitely a city for artists.
Yes, we like to think so. And the weather has been warm.
But you know what, though? It is not humid like it is in New York City. And
exactly.
This is a beautiful swampless haven.
And you're from Connecticut? Is
yes,
that right?
That's right.
Where in Connecticut are you
from? I'm from Stamford. So it's about like 40-minute drive from Manhattan. So the suburbs of New York City.
Yeah, essentially.
And the tri-state area is where my whole family mostly is. And but I am always thankful to be out of the city in July.
Seriously. I also, as you know, just got back from Connecticut. And like every time I stepped outside for a week, even though it was like 90 degrees, I would giggle because it was not oppressively wet.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you shower and you feel like you need another shower right away. It's gross.
It's awful.
So it's cooled down quite a bit. And I love it here. So I'm really
awesome.
Happy.
Good to know. Well, hopefully you'll keep coming back then.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. So Syracuse, did you direct Native Gardens at Syracuse?
I did.
Okay,
and
great.
And it was actually this awesome opportunity because it was a three pro. It started at Syracuse and then it went to Jiva Theater Center in Rochester and then it went across the country here to Portland. Same set, same actors, same everybody.
Cool.
And because it was three Lort theaters with an all female of color design team, with, you know, also me and the playwright being Latinas, we were had a big feature in American Theater Magazine
awesome.
The time. And it was really, really fun. And it was really cool to see a show in three very different cities and what the audience response was. It's how I really got to know Portland really quickly.
Oh yeah. How was our response different maybe than?
I found, so Native Gardens is a comedy. You have a liberal, Latin couple and a Republican, white couple, and they're arguing there. It's a border, dispute of their garden in the backyard. It's very, it's a comedy, but it's got a lot of underlying things. And this was written pre-2016. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's like you're laughing, but there's serious things at play. And I found Portland took sides.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, were they taking sides against, like, themselves or...
Maybe.
Yeah, okay. but not, like, one side. Like, they took sides...
No, one side.
One side.
Majority.
Majority.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Liberal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's great for me. Uh-huh. In my own bias, but it was pretty fascinating.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I always wonder when you are, do you do a lot of like regional popping around directing in other places, or are you pretty New York based?
So I used to be everywhere. I would joke that when I lived in New York City before COVID, I think I was home like 3 to 4 months a year. And that was bananas, but I was quite younger then. And yeah. And now that I'm a middle-aged woman,
right.
I'm based in New York City and I work remotely for Syracuse Stage. And I find that regionally, I'm mostly in Syracuse when I'm directing, and I'm directing more and more in New York City, which is the hope. And so coming out to Portland is a fluke, but a great one.
Okay, great. Yeah, because I always wonder, like, whether directors need to know anything about the audience that they're directing for when they are, like, in a different city or if they just direct the play.
Yeah. I think it's smart to know your audience before going in. And usually you get that from your artistic director and, you know, and you learn a lot by what play you're doing. And usually I'm directing the edgy play by a non-white writer in a community. So I'm so used to going in and kind of stirring things up and challenging people, which is my favorite kind of play. It's the thing that speaks to me the most and is really fun to talk about with audiences because usually they're, you know, asking questions and engaging and it's fun. I really love it.
Do you think Reggie Hoops is a play that is going to stir any pots? Is it a pot-stirring play? Is it a dialogue, a fiery... Hopefully every play is a dialogue-starting play, although that's obviously not always the case. But do you think it's going to spark a lot of conversations or...
Yes, but I think it's more a play... It's not like a politically challenging play in my opinion, but I think it's really getting folks to think about their relationship to their own family, their own jobs. This play is a lot about how we sacrifice our family, ourselves for a job that we love that kind of can take over our identity. I especially relate to that as an artist because I joke that I have no life outside of theater, which is kind of a sad joke when you think
about it. Yeah, I was like, that's not a joke. That's a thing that's true that we just laugh at so that we feel better about not having a life outside of theater.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's a really big theme of sacrifice in this play. And a lot of family legacy, and a lot of family legacies harbor a lot of secrets. Yeah, it's such a good play because it's got so many layers. And every day we rehearse, we're in our second week right now. We're constantly talking about new things we find in the text between characters and the theme. And there's just a lot that Chris has packed into it. I've been calling it the next great American family drama. But it's also very funny. So there's a lot of humor and there's this crazy arc. I don't want to give things away. There's this crazy arc that Reggie goes through as the protagonist, who is pretty set on her decisions until things go sideways. And so it's exciting. I think people are going to be talking about the story of the play and debating on what decisions should be made versus oh, that shouldn't have happened, or like politically that's wrong, like nothing like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I am curious. I also not giving anything away, but like, we'll be curious to hear when people leave the theater, how they've, whether it's like a happy ending or, you know, whether they're like, yeah, that was the thing that that's the thing I wanted to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Versus like, oh no, I don't know if that's what I wanted to happen. Chris and I were talking about this living room drama as compared to the last show we did, which was Our Orange Sky by Chris Pena, which is also like super similar in some ways, right? Do you know that show at all?
I don't. I know Chris, but I don't know that play.
Yeah, so it's it is a very, very personal sort of autobiographical, like this Latino son comes back from Hollywood, you know, having won these awards for writing, and is like, you know, it's from this immigration story perspective of like, my parents moved here to like give me these opportunities, and so I feel really compelled to take advantage of them, and so I kind of like work myself to death and, you know, to achieve what they wanted me to achieve and what their version of success is like, and then I'm not sure that it's good for me or makes me happy. That's like a parallel that Chris and I talked about.
Oh yeah,
about.
There's very similar themes.
Totally.
Yeah.
And obviously, like, maybe I'm like pushing them a little closer together.
No, you're right.
But I think it is, and what is interesting about it is, you know, this is like our double season is the American generation, so we're thinking a lot about immigration. Mm-hmm. Chris Pena's family situation, they moved from Honduras to the Bay Area and like acquired all this wealth. So like there was both a geographical movement, but also like a class movement, and a major culture shift, right? And like all of those things exist in this play, I think. Do you see resonance with like a quote unquote immigration story?
Reggie's parents, their character names are Iz and Ben. They are American. Iz is Puerto Rican and Irish, and Ben is Black. Born and raised in the U.S. So, but there is a parallel in what you're saying to their relationship to the Bronx, because they're born and raised in the Bronx, and then they move to Westchester, to the suburbs, to a more affluent, with a house versus an apartment. And also, you know, growing up, we see them get married in 1977, which historically at that time in the Bronx was a very, very tumultuous period, with the Summer of Sam, with incredible, difficult economic disparities going on at the time in the city. We have a really amazing dramaturg, Wesley Tipton, who did a lot of research for us to help with that. And there's a tension between Ben and Iz, because Ben really, really wants to get out of the Bronx because he's seeing all this violence, and he's kind of blaming the community instead of really opening up and see the system that is impacting and kind of, you know, it's a bigger than just one community of people. And is really about, you know, really protecting her community and giving them the benefit of the doubt. But ultimately, they do move to Scarsdale because they come into some money. And everybody wants, you know, their kids, the next generation, to do better than than themselves. That's, you know, valid. But it's interesting. There's sort of a valorization, a glamorization of the Bronx with Reggie and her brother Muncie, and the Bronx is ever present, even though they're not there anymore. And they're named after famous Yankee players who are emblematic of the 70s of that time, Reggie Jackson and Thurman Munson. And so there's this this shadow legacy within that, and the Bronx is constantly being brought up, and yeah, that everything you're saying about Chris Pena's play and this play have a lot in common with it has a lot to do with class, and it has a lot to do with doing better than your parents. But what does that mean exactly? It's like, does it mean that you have a fancy job? Does it mean that you get to have kids? Like, Reggie is married to a woman. Her name is Bells. They have kids. They have a house. And that in itself is an achievement. But is it, you know, depending on who's asking? So there's just a lot going on. There's a lot of... Ben says, my kids will be able to marry whoever they want. But who knows if what Reggie marrying Bells is what they intended, you know, like what does that mean? You know, like Ben and Iz are in an interracial marriage versus, you know, Reggie's in a gay marriage, you know, like, did you really mean it?
For sure.
My mom kind of deals with the same thing with me. So it's a really juicy play because there's just a lot going on. When you break it down.
Yes, no, absolutely. Yeah, Chris's writing is really, I don't want to say dense. It's very accessible, but yeah, very layered, I guess, is the right way of saying it.
Yeah.
I was thinking about, like, how when I interviewed Chris about this, he talked about, you know, he's very much the kid who was brought out of, I think it was the Bronx, like, mm-hmm. brought out of the Bronx. I think that his parents moved before he was born, but then would go and visit the Bronx, mm-hmm. Visit like his cousins and stuff that were still there. And especially in the era where hip hop was really coming into its own, which is a huge thing for Chris. He was like, that's where like, it was really cool. It was really cool to be there. And part of what like made it really cool to be there, I think, was the fact that, as you referenced, there was like, people were turning intense economic and like just like structural social hardship into art mm. and relationships and connections. And there really was. I was like reading an article about this theory or this idea, or maybe it's just like the framing of this article about how the blackout, which is referenced, mm-hmm. sort of jump-started the hip-hop movement in New York because of all the looting mm. of, like, all of these disenfranchised and just, like, folks who were struggling just looted all of these stores and then had all of this equipment.
Yeah.
I wish I knew. Do you have a relationship to hip hop?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I grew up in Connecticut. But we actually lived in the Heights until I was about three. It's really hilarious, actually, because my mom, I was supposed to be born in New York City, but my mom was freaked out because in the 80s, a lot of kids were being switched at birth.
What?
By accident.
What?
And so she, you know, she was really young. And so she, at the last second, like literally was in labor. And so she drove to Stanford where she was born to have me. Because she's insane. That's why I was born there. But we actually lived in the Heights at the time.
Wild.
I know.
I'm going to have to go do a whole thing on... I'm going to have to go look up why kids were being switched at birth.
Yeah, so that's... So it's funny that there's that tension even in my birth story, but being so close to the city... Also, my parents split when I was four, and so I was in the city every other weekend mm-hmm. to see my dad, And I'm Puerto Rican, I'm Dominican and Chilean. And so also Latin music is a huge part of my life and growing up. And so, and my mom was young and she was still partying quite into my childhood. She was in her 20s, like early 20s. So, you know, she was partying every weekend, and not every weekend, but you know, my grandma would come over. I would help her, you know, pick out her outfits. And my mom's really hot. So, yeah. You know, and we would dance in the living room before she'd go out. And we were dancing to all like hip hop, salsa. We mm-hmm. like everything that came out, we would go buy the cassette, the single cassette tape. Mm-hmm. Like, and my mom was an amazing dancer. And so she, and then I would be making breakfast with my grandma the next day and she'd be coming home from partying.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And so that was part of my childhood. And then, my, her husband, my sister's dad, was also into breakdancing because he grew up in the mm-hmm, Bronx. Mm-hmm. So his family would come over and they would breakdance and they would, you know, we were always listening to music. They were, and they were making music. And so music was a big part of my life. And I loved hip hop. I would literally keep a blank cassette tape in the radio. Kids, this is how hard it used to be before iTunes, even before CDs. And I would be listening to 97.1, Hot 97, and hit record when the DJ would be playing on every Friday and make my own, you know, mixtapes. I would write down the lyrics to rap songs and then I would change them. At the time, the boys I liked.
Oh my goodness.
And then I would give it to them. It was like, so I know I was very, yeah.
Wait, like, would you, like it was obviously like, this is something that, that I've just like written down someone else's lyrics
yeah.
and altered them, or like, were you trying to pass it off?
No,
as your own? Oh, okay.
This Great. Was like LL Cool J's song. And then I put your name in here and here you go.
That's adorable.
And, yeah, I was a big hip hop head and, love, I still am. And I've always wanted to direct more, plays with hip hop in it. And so, this play really speaks to me in that regard. And because I was always in the city as a kid and you know, and our big family would come to us, like we were, you know, you know, my family is into partying. And so we were always dancing and just having fun. And so, music's a big deal. And I was in dance as a kid from age 4 to high school. Like I was in music. I was tap dancing, doing hip hop, doing jazz.
Okay,
I was
okay.
on stage my whole life.
Okay. Okay.
Cause I thought I was going to be an actor.
Okay. yeah.
So yeah, no, this play doesn't have as much music in it but it's a big part of Christopher's
yes.
identity
yes,
and
yes,
mine
yes,
too.
Yes.
We bond over it yeah. quite often. Actually.
This is good. Good. Well, maybe there's a future collaboration there.
Oh, that would be awesome.
And did you know Chris before this project?
I knew of him because he's amazing. And, you know, I saw his production of Chad Deedy off Broadway in 2010. And that we joke, you know, he's got a little tiny play on Broadway right now.
He might have mentioned
it. You know, and I don't know what it is or who he's working with.
Uh-huh.
But we make fun of him all the time because it is a really big achievement.
Yeah.
And we're so.
And he's such a good sport.
I know. I've always wanted to work with him and he's awesome. And the minute we met, it felt like we had known each other. And so it's been a super natural collaboration. And I'm excited for him to come back and see what we're doing.
Me too. okay. Well, I think I asked him, a la Ezra Klein, about books that he recommended. But I'm going to ask you, for someone who is like, for someone whose knowledge of hip hop is essentially stops at Lin-Manuel Miranda. Okay.
I don't even think of Lin as a hip hop person, I guess I should.
That's funny.
I think of him as musical theater, but he really is.
Sure, totally.
Because the minute I heard Hamilton had a Ten Crack Commandments adaptation, I was like, yeah. OMG, yeah. That's brilliant.
Yeah, and it's good, I think.
It is.
So what would be your recommending starter albums for an aspiring, wanting to be able to bond more
with
hip hop and broaden my horizons and not bring up In the Heights and Hamilton when hip hop comes up?
oh man, so many. I would I mean, Lil Kim is, she's kind of, to me, besides MC Light, the first, like, queen of hip-hop.
Okay.
And that opens the door to Bad Boy, which I know Puffy's canceled, and he legitimately is awful, but... Lil Kim, because then you get a Notorious B.I.G., who's one of the best rappers of all time. I think that is a good starting place. Yeah, whenever I need to feel like a badass, I put on Lil Kim.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
I love that. That's what I want from my, my hip-hop experience, yeah. For sure. That's what I would be looking for. Okay, great. Well, thank you for
your time.
I'm really excited to see the show. I do love the show, and I'm excited to see what y'all are doing with it.
Thank you. Everybody, come buy a ticket, tell a friend.
Yes, come buy a ticket, tell a friend.
The world premiere of Reggie Hoops opens Saturday, August 3rd and runs through Sunday, August 11th with previews on August 1st and 2nd. Members of the LGBTQIA+ community can join us for Pride Affinity Night on Thursday, August 1st. We also offer a BIPOC Affinity Night Thursday, August 8th. Our affinity nights include a pre-show reception with free wine and snacks and a ticket to the show for only $5. Visit profiletheater.org for tickets and more information about those events. Also, Melissa Crespo is staying in town beyond the opening of Reggie Hoops to direct a staged reading of a play called Beheading Columbus by Diana Burbano, presented in collaboration with Advanced Gender Equity in the Arts. Diana Burbano is a recipient of AGE's Legacy Grant, which is aimed at BIPOC women over the age of 40. In Beheading Columbus, Alana, a proud Latina, sends off a DNA sample for genetic testing in hopes of gaining greater knowledge of her family's indigenous roots, only to uncover a family secret that calls into question everything she's built her identity and career around. This one-time staged reading of Beheading Columbus is free and performs on Monday, August 5th, 7 p.m. at Imago Theater. For tickets to Beheading Columbus and all the performances of Reggie Hoops, visit profiletheater.org, and we hope to see you at the theater.